terms of psychic vampirism, let's say, like, I guess we've all had experiences that somebody who believed in a model of psychic vampirism would interpret as that, if you see what I mean. So the way that people can offload their stuff onto us, or the reverse, like drain our energy by holding our attention when we don't want to be held by them, you know, by just talking and talking about stuff that just doesn't interest us but is full of emotional unconscious load. And, you know, just like, I work in a thrift store, so I this is a daily experience for me, but it didn't used to be. But everybody's had that experience of being in the company of somebody and they feel they can't disengage, and they feel like either their energy's being drained or that they're getting kind of gunked or slimed by this person. So that, you know, there isn't an obvious physical element to that, if you see what I mean. Like, we can still experience our interior space being violated.
There's a difference between that, which I understand, and psychic killing. I mean, that's a whole different concept, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
And she talks about, I don't know, how much of this stuff do you want to go into, like the more gruesome aspects of it, or whether you'd rather just, is that sort of thing?
Well, I'm not squeamish about it. I'm squeamish about disinformation, but I don't know Carol Rutz. And if you say that she's, I don't know why I haven't heard of her, because I feel like I've heard of a lot, and I tend to consider
and
most of them.
And yeah? I was a guest, wasn't she, on your... And she refers to Carol Rutz.
Okay, so I have heard of her, but I just didn't retain it. I mean, I'm cautious about all of these, the survivor testimonies, because the ones who've put themselves forward or been put forward as testifiers, I find they do tend to be compromised in some form or another. But beyond that, yeah, I'm not bothered. Yeah, I can go into any detail you like.
Well, she talks about having embryos removed and then breeding her babies with enlarged heads. That she was showing pictures of her children, which had the babies, which had massively enlarged heads, and she understands this to be related to this system, this psychic killing or psychic phenomena, that they're attempting to enlarge some aspect of the child. So. Yeah, that's just an aspect of which I don't understand, and therefore I can't say one way or another. I don't know what to do with that information, really. I mean, I remember as a child trying to move things with my mind, and so I don't know how, that's probably quite common, but I never had much success. So, yeah.
Right, well, so yeah, psychism is certainly a difficult thing, and I don't know if you've read any of Prisoner Infinity, but that's addressing that.
I have read it, yeah.
A lot of the time in terms of, yeah, well, in general terms. So, I mean, I think it is a continuum, what I was talking about, in terms of when we interact with other human organisms. I'm going to keep using that phrase now, I quite like it. That we experience ways in which we're influenced and able to influence that aren't observable, you know, at a physical or a sensory level. So it doesn't mean they're extrasensory by any means. Like the way that bodies communicate, body language, smells, and all the rest of it, most of that's unconscious too. And then there's this the added element of energetic transference. So, like, how we can be aware when somebody's looking at the back of our neck, or, you know, when somebody enters our space and we don't actually hear or see them, we can just, well, various different phenomena that we can pretty much confirm that there's an energetic dimension to existence as well. that I'd see that all as a spectrum. So, and then, so at the thin end, we've just got these day-to-day experiences which we don't really question, but we would admit are a bit anomalous. And then at the thick end, you've got somebody like Whitley Strieber, who travels through time and other dimensions and all the rest of it. And
My reading of all of those kinds of things is that it's bullshit, and that's a cover for it's a cover for a form of psychological operation both on you and on them. And that's the same. I mean, I tried to read one of David Icke's books once, and the same thing I felt out of that was that there's good information in here, but there's just so much bullshit. There's so much paraphernalia that it's not really helpful, and that perhaps is why why he has left, managed to carry on in that way. So I try and, as I said, I have a background in physics, and I try to approach things to a certain extent from that. Because I still respect a lot of the concepts and the methods of thinking that I was taught, and also at heart, I suppose I am very much an empiricist, empirical. I value empirical, the empirical approach. I think it's a safe way to negotiate all of the deception, really, and also because of the sort of work that I do, that I'm always regularly having to deal with the world in that way, in a visceral way. So yeah, I'm not really convinced by the idea of an alien abduction itself. I mean, certainly I understand abduction, and I understand people pretending to be aliens or pretending to be demons and those sorts of things, as a means of controlling that person and deceiving and frightening that person. But my feeling is that it always comes back to people and aspects of people, aspects of human imagination.
Well, I pretty much agree, but then you ended on a big word, which is imagination, and what that what does that word mean, and what are the limits of human imagination? I mean, obviously, in terms of leading to action, there are no limits. Pretty much, if a person can imagine something, they can then act on it. It doesn't mean they can fly, but it means they can jump out of a window and kill themselves or throw someone else out, and so on. So, in terms of the consequences, the imagination obviously is a powerful tool that can be exploited and all the rest of it. But then, if you factor in the imagination itself, if we leave aside for now, like the possible spiritual dimensions of imagination, to use a word I don't particularly like to use, but the unknown dimensions of the imagination, like it could be a creative faculty, let's say. I mean, like a real, really creative, like to manifest stuff. Leave aside that question, like stigmata, for example, just to give you an empirical example of the imagination manifesting physical. But if we leave aside that for now, the overlap between dissociation and imagination, as in the extent to which we developed imagination as a survival tool, via states of dissociation that were brought about through trauma, and bringing it back to the physical thing, if that can even cause somatic effects like stigmata, then to what extent can a person through dissociation access realms of experience that are hidden from the ego? Like you said early on, the ego is created in order not to see certain things. So then, what are those things that we're not seeing? Well, yeah, there are organized programs of abuse and, family secrets and so on, like stuff that can be very, very mundane and sordid and just, all too ordinary, all too human. But It may also include phenomena that not that it's not human, but that isn't what we would think of as mundane, and that has been sort of grouped under in a second matrix of supernatural, occult, alien, and so on, and all, this second matrix that's been created partly as a cover for and a distortion of real phenomena, and partly as a means to harness it, I would say. Like if dissociation and fragmentation does entail an energetic component, as in psychic energy. Again, it's a big question mark. Like, what is psychic energy? I don't know. I just feel I know that there is such a thing. Let's just say, and if that energy can be harnessed through belief, just as physical energy can be harnessed through belief, then what kind of realities could it be creating? It's a real cliché to say, well, if people believe something, it becomes true, and but it's not very empirical. You could say, if people believe in Jim Jones, they might kill themselves. Of course, I don't believe they did, but anyway, whatever. That people might act on a fervent belief and do things that they wouldn't normally do. We know that, but would they actually be able to physically experience things? Would they actually see things that they wouldn't normally see? And what does that, is it enough just to say they're hallucinating because they've been persuaded to believe something, when you and I can agree that actually the world that we're seeing on a day-to-day level, in a certain sense, is a hallucination that we've been hypnotized to see and believe in.
Yeah, and another aspect of that is, I don't know what the technical term would be, but it's something like evolutionary regression, that there are es elements within the human construction which are, through the process of biological evolution, that have remnants of prior times and prior organisms, prior methods of survival. And I think that is another aspect of the regression that happens within systematic torture programs on children, is that they're attempting to access earlier aspects of the human organism, prior evolutionary states that are remnants within the brain or remnants within the body. And I think that is another area where you can be non-human, where you're non-human, but you're still within a human body, but you have been accessed in such a way that you are in a prior you're relating to yourself or your body through a prior evolutionary state, and therefore the lizard is a common phrase around that kind of thing. So there again, it's something that you can, as I said, you can observe it, but and it is within us, but it is also not us, not it's not human.
And the DNA even. And how real is the DNA? Well, it's a scientific model, we can't verify it, but I kind of stopped my own thought there because we don't actually know if DNA is real. But if we're gonna, I guess it's back to my last point, which is, the very criteria that we're using to judge what's real and what's unreal and what's possible and what's not possible are the criteria that we haven't checked it. We haven't verified the criteria we're using. So what, I mean, what do we absolutely know is that we're conscious and we're perceiving, or that I am. I know that I am. That all I absolutely know for sure is consciousness exists because I'm conscious of it. And that from, as consciousness, I can perceive or perception happens. That's all I absolutely know for sure. And that doesn't mean that I'm, going to be open to all the new age woo-woo that, everything you can imagine is real and so on and so forth, because it's clear how much that is a trap and how it's been used to manipulate us and to trap us. But on the other hand, and so I agree with you, like I have the similar kind of desire, like Jan Erwin too, you know, just look around and look at the objects I can touch and verify and just start from that and try and stay there. But like Jan Erwin brought up in our conversation, like the idea of the primary of consciousness is part of the lie that they're using to ensnare us. Well, no, I mean, maybe it is, but it's not a lie, because primacy of consciousness, as I just pointed out, is absolutely empirical. Like that, I'd say that's the one thing we can question what consciousness is, of course, but then we're just chasing our tail. So then, on the one hand, there's the verifiability of physical objects seems like the ground, but actually deeper than that ground is that without consciousness we wouldn't be able to verify, and as consciousness we can't actually verify that these things are there. Not really. We can just observe that. You know, like every morning I wake up, not every morning, but most mornings I wake up, I get in the shower, and I have a thought, oh, I wonder if I'm dreaming now. Not because it feels like a dream, but just because, I don't know, it's just a thought I have. Like, and the thing that makes me know that I'm not dreaming is that everything remains consistent. And like I say, oh, it's exactly the same shower and bathroom as, you know, the last 1,000 mornings I woke up. But that's it. It's the only thing that, and that's, you know. Like I've had dreams where I absolutely knew that I wasn't dreaming and that I was in another reality, and they were terrifying. And I would say, talking to you now, that I was right, that that's true. But obviously, I can't verify it. It's just my consciousness. My consciousness told me that was a real realm, just as it's telling me now that this is, but only relative to, you know, only for now, sort of thing.
Yeah, but for me, I don't worry about that sort of thing. I don't have time, I think, for that.
For what though? I mean, what is it? Like what?
For worrying about primacy. I think.
But isn't, I mean, aren't we talking about verifying and trying to keep to the ground? So, I mean, that's what I would say that I have time to worry about. It's the only thing I have time to worry about is, you know, how much am I sticking to what I know and what's real, or how much am I getting closer to it?
But I don't believe there's a perfect answer to that question. I don't believe that life is like that. I think it's a question of commitment and doing your best and not attempting to answer that sort of question. It's more a case of who needs you, who needs your help, and that's something that I focus on more, is that my family need me, and I don't. That's more the primary, and so I do my best from that position. And rather than and I feel that if I'm involved more in those sorts of philosophical questions, that I'm not helping them as much as I could. And that I don't know where that's just an inherent feeling, I suppose.
Right, but they're talking to me now, so you know what I mean? Like I absolutely agree with what you said. I was going to say respect it, but respect, I don't know if it's the right word, but I empathize with it, that to be of service to others is really fundamental to being a human organism, let's say, like just being present. But that means that it's whoever I'm with and whatever the situation I'm in, like how can I most serve this organism and the environment, you know, within it. It's not like I try and work it out, but it's a spontaneous thing, like just trying to be present. And then, but so then, you know, the question of what's philosophical and what's practical isn't that a moving line? Like, for me, it's not. I don't know. I can't be sure, but I wouldn't say it's exactly a philosophical question, or I would say that philosophical questions are very practical.
Yeah, to be honest, I can't speak in absolutes about any of these things, and I always try and avoid doing that. My focus is on doing something productive. So,
Wow.
I have a sense of what that means. I have a sense of if I'm doing something useful, and I'm happy for people to say you're wrong, and that what you're saying is incorrect, and I'm more interested in that sense of accomplishment, accomplishing something, rather than deciding any particular question. So with respect
You
to,
mean, yeah, go ahead.
no, sorry.
I was just saying, you mean physically accomplishing something.
Yes, in the world, in the real world, something foundational, something reliable, something structural, and something for other people to rest on, something for them to rely on.
What if you were through conversing, let's say, to keep it in the present, about abstract things, if somehow that led to a recognition of a key defense mechanism in your ego and led to it dissolving, you know, being highly optimistic. If that were to happen, wouldn't that be a an attainment of equal value?
And I don't pretend to know exactly what's going to be useful. All I have done over time is to follow my own instinct and my own experience. If I have a painful experience behaving and interacting in a certain way, I then say, okay, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something different. And it's just been a process of experimentation, really, of experience and working things out over time. You know, there's just so much time. One needs a lot of time to really to really do that.
Yeah. Well, if we bring this back to what we were talking about with culture, because one of the things we were talking about was how culture is this bubble where we don't have to engage with the reality of death, and it buffers us from physical hardship, and it's abstract. And so it would be fairly easy to make a correlation between what we're talking about here, as in your preference for more physical engagement as opposed to abstract exploration or contemplation. I mean, I don't necessarily agree, but I'm just pointing that out that,
It's not that I don't engage in abstract contemplation. That's not my proof. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. So,
Yeah, that's what Cypher said.
I'm committed to the experience of the thing.
Well, I mean, it's okay. So, yeah, this is interesting because we've got a living example. And you and I were talking. We're making a podcast, so something practical is going to come out of it, which you can have a sense of accomplishment, perhaps, etc. So it meets all those criteria, but we're actually, it's also very abstract because we're not even in the same room or the same country. And so we're very limited in terms of what you're talking about, potentially anyway, unless you're going to allow for energetic connections and stuff. We're quite limited in terms of practically working together. You know, we're limited to words, which are always conceptual. Like we can talk about building a table, but it won't build a table, right? Whatever we talk about, it's going to stay conceptual.
What when I read your material, when I read your blog, was that it reorganized my way of thinking. And as I said to you on Twitter, it's elevated my thinking, elevated my understanding. And I felt privy to a way of thinking, a way of organizing myself, which I hadn't had before. And so the reason I wanted to speak to you was to continue that process, for myself, to so that I can better understand, and I can better think about things. So that has a direct influence in how I can organize my life here. It's not that's not an abstract thing. It affects my own health and the health of the people around me. So, that's not abstract at all.
No. Yeah. So, how, what do you mean by, like, how did it help you organize? What did it help you organize?
It helped me organize myself, such that I mean that really, I feel like that has been one of my main projects in terms of coming from that position as a child of disorganization and wanting to feel not like I was stimulating pain all the time and that I wasn't subject to being pushed around by my own pain. And so the process of grieving and of re-experiencing those of past suffering is necessary to reorganize oneself so that those parts of yourself are not in conflict anymore. They're not speaking with a different voice. They speak with your voice, and you realize that each of those internal voices is actually your voice. And I understand that as being a process of self-organization. And so what I got from your writing was a higher level of organization, self-organization, that I felt internally more integrated. Yeah.
And did that happen at a conscious level, as in you read what I wrote and then you applied something and then there was a result, or was it just that it was a result that you observed that came about through reading?
I was aware of the quality of it immediately, and I thought, well, this is new to me. I haven't been able to think like this before. And then having then slept, because I'm a very vivid dreamer, and I dream every night. My dreaming is very important to me. And then through my dreaming, I then embodied it myself. It became part of myself.
And were there specific elements then that you talk about? Like, would you think there were resonances? I mean, obviously you resonated with what I wrote, but were there specific areas of resonance in terms of experience?
I think your description of English culture, of the class system, aspects of the class system. I mean, I grew up in a sort of, both my parents were actors, but not successful. So we didn't have much money, but there was a sort of aspect of middle classness about it, I suppose. But it wasn't it wasn't a sort of successful experience. But so I didn't come from, and that in a sense is what I mean about a way of thinking, is that you're coming from a higher social strata. I feel like you're privy to a kind of education and a kind of more honest form of thinking, or you're permitted to think more honestly about yourself and about other people. You probably would disagree with that, I suppose. But so there were elements of that which I'd never been exposed to. And so that was intriguing to me, and clearly. I mean, for example, with Jimmy Savile, there are some very obvious questions around that, which are not asked within the mainstream, which would lead one to then expose a great deal more. And I was a child during the 1980s, and so I watched Jim Will Fix It and that sort of thing, and so that was, and at the time I thought this is odd. And I don't like this program. I don't like this feeling. I don't like pop music. I don't like Top of the Pops. I don't like all of these things. But I didn't really understand why. And so that decoding process of culture, British culture, was, I suppose, the key thing that resonated with me. But in terms of the elevation aspect of my own thinking, that more to do, I think, it with your own personality, which comes through in your writing.
Personality, or is it what you were referring to at the start, like some sort of self-deconstructed ego thing? Like having a more deconstructed, less constructed ego. I don't know how to put it, because I'm not going to be the one who says it.
I mean, as I said before, I very much appreciated that courage that I could see in the writing. It's quite funny. There's a picture of you in your De Ruyter articles where you have this sort of glazed stare. The picture says when you came back from one of these retreats or something like that. And that's it seems like such a distant kind of experience to where you are now. But that person, was on the other side of something which is on the other side of a traumatic release. And I very much appreciate and recognize that you've been through that and are in the process of reconstructing yourself without that aspect of your conditioning.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm not really sure what's happening there in terms of the reconstruction. But I was thinking about this today, that I just seem to be having more frequent and more acute experience of, and this I wanted to touch on this when we were talking earlier about the cultural conspiracy, that there are ways of behaving that include ways of thinking and perceiving and feeling that we've learned, we've been trained in, and we've learned from a very early time that feel empowering, that are reassuring, that make us feel safe. And you know, this is how we all become complicit with the whole cultural conspiracy, because it gives us the tools that we think we will need to be safe, powerful, you know, functioning, and all the rest of it. But that you know, they're it's a deal with the devil. They take more than they give, and so the self-examination, self-deconstruction process means letting go of these things one by one, it seems. And I'm not sure if they're getting replaced with something or not, but the experience I'm doing this podcast is often an opportunity for that, because each time I speak to somebody, it's usually somebody new, it's somebody I don't know, and I really don't want to have a shtick and be the guy who says this and so on. I just want to be responding to the other person, and so this is this constant experience of not actually knowing what tools I have, or what ways, or what my personality is, really, is what I'm saying. Like, who am I? It's a little cliche again. But, so, in terms of a reconstructed identity, I'm not, that's a big question mark for me, because, and I think this is why when we were talking about the psychism and stuff, and you were saying that, you know, for you it was too abstract and you didn't have experience of it, and I was trying to introduce it as valid. I think it relates to this also, is that I think as the ego, whatever happens to that constructed identity as it starts coming apart, I think we do experience ourselves as less linear, you know. And that can have a transcendental or sort of magical aspect to it, of being outside of time and whatnot. I'm not saying I have those experiences, I don't, except when I dream. But I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't, how much my experience of reality depends on having an internally coherent experience of identity. I don't know, you know, if my identity completely dissolved, if that's possible or desirable, I have no idea what reality would be like. I just don't. But I do experience this this growing sense of uncertainty about who I am and what I want to say next, really, is what it comes down to. You know, because the identity is the part that speaks, and the flip side, we use talking to reinforce our identity, of course, thinking internally even more so. But there's that symbiotic relationship between identity and language, and so as one comes undone, the other's coming undone too, and then reality itself is, you know, filtered through language. And anyway, it's a very long-winded way of Responding to your point about this reconstruction, as is, you know, I don't actually know if that's happening, so I can't confirm that. I can confirm that something's coming undone. But I mean, I look back on that time with John. Yes, it does seem like a different person, but that, I mean, on one hand, I've always had that sense, like even in the present, depersonalization. And on the other hand, it's becoming more and more acute, but I would say more and more benign. Like it used to be a tormenting thing, of sense of being unreal and being unalienated, and you know, I would do all the things to reinforce the sense of who I was through the culture, and through achieving stuff and accomplishing stuff and becoming a culture maker, and that it does seem to be coming unravelled, so that the experience of not knowing who I am is becoming less and less oppressive, and so then there's less and less of a need to, you know, reinforce old ideas about who I am.
I think letting go of identity is important, very important in feeling freer and not worrying about it. I think that again is something, a tool of control, and that ties into the fear of dying, because you're invested in this thing which will disappear. And reclaiming that. All of these things are to do with investing in things outside of yourself and transitory things, and in reclaiming those things to within yourself, and letting go of identity and ego and so on, property. There's a release. You get a release from that oppression, and you become more self-reliant, and you have more self-respect. That's very important. You feel respect, self-respect, because you act in accordance with yourself, your desires, and you're not filled with questioning all the time.
Yeah, it's becoming less fragmented.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I think part of that, and you seem to suggest that too, with these voices, part of that is becoming aware, of course, of how one is fragmented. One would naturally experience it more viscerally, because when we're fragmented, we move from one fragment to the other, and we forget that we've moved. We think that it's consistent, but it's not. And so, when the fragmentation begins to heal, I think we become aware of the movement from f between fragments more, and so we feel more fragmented.
You catch it, you can see it happening as you become more aware. And you're not, what, when you are right in it, you're stalked by it, you're constantly stalked by it, and it's on your back, over your shoulder, always, from behind, isn't it? That's in Sartre, that's in one of his books. I remember that, where he's saying from behind, from behind. It's that feeling of from something from behind always. And it's that you reintegrate that demon or the thing outside you, and you realize it's yourself, that you're stalking yourself. And so instead of looking outside, and that's again relates to the transgender aspect, is that instead of looking outside to resolve your fear or your discomfort externally, you take it into yourself, and you stop stalking yourself.
Thank you. kind of a trope, although it hasn't been in that many movies and not very many good ones, I don't think. But, you know, the detective who's hunting a killer and then finds out that he's the killer.
Yeah.
That metaphor is one I always liked. And it has a disturbingly literal interpretation if one is investigating mind control. And
that was a word for you, wasn't it? That you had something like...
Yeah, and because I haven't thought about it recently, and yet we've been talking about mind control, and then I was just talking about my own fragmentation and so on, and so like, I mean, part of what you would have got from reading Occult Yorkshire, whether it was conscious or not, was the experience of somebody who's moving into an awareness that there are parts of my life and my identity that are hidden from me, and that I can't rule anything out. Anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just as on a macrocosmic level, when you start to look into these programs of mind control, you start to realize that you can't rule anything out about what other people are doing in the world. Like, anything becomes possible, not in a, you know, supernatural sense, but just in terms of human, how awful it could be.
Then it's
the same at an inner level for me. I mean, you've said that there's nothing like that in your past. Well, I would have said that 10 years ago, right? So whenever somebody says that, I don't believe them, I don't disbelieve them, I just say, well, whatever, you know. It's not necessarily possible to know, and so that's something that I was doing in a theoretical level for my whole life. Like, I read about serial killers when I was a teenager, and I identified with Frank Booth when I was 20 in Blue Velvet. Like, I always had this predilection for the darkness, and I would have always said, you know, even as a teenager, that I was capable of anything, and that was true of everyone else. That sympathy for the devil thing, I always had that at a theoretical level, but in the last few years via Occult Yorkshire, it's become more than theoretical, and I've had dream memories, and I should say dreams that could be memories that suggest that, yeah, that something was done to me. And that, I mean, Wendy Hoffman, when I brought it up, she said that it would be very, very unlikely, almost impossible, for somebody to be part of these programs and not to have committed terrible acts, because that's an integral part of how they control you.
Yeah.
Right? So... I mean, it's still theoretical because I don't have any memories, but it certainly widened the reach of that, what could be seen as an intellectual exercise, if it wasn't so emotionally deranging, of allowing for the possibility of anything. I suppose being in unknowing, I mean, I think that's probably a central part of it, in terms of, I mean, on the one hand, just being willing to welcome back any fragments, no matter how awful they are, is really, like, until we're open enough to let anything back in, it's not going to come back in. Or until we're open enough to let whatever's there back in, I should say. And we don't know that it includes everything, obviously. But, you know, if there's certain things we're not willing to see, and that overlaps with things that are there, then we won't be able to integrate them. So there's that, and then in a much more perhaps philosophical sense, but I would say still real, being able to be in a state of uncertainty about existence and oneself, I think that is a kind of sauna, if you will, sweat lodge for the ego, because it can't deal with uncertainty and ambiguity. Like, this could be true, but that could be true. And a lot of what I do, it actually intensifies that, because I talk about things that are very controversial and very hard to think about. Like you were saying earlier, well, and about the ego, it's hardwired not to see certain things and so on. I talk about those sorts of things, and then, of course, I encounter disagreement from people, and it's very hard. It's a real challenge for me not to be argumentative, not to be certain and say, no, you're wrong about this, right? But it doesn't, you know, that even if I know, I also know that I can't really know at a deeper level, the deepest level, I can't really know any of this. Even if I were to remember things that had happened to me, would I absolutely know? Yeah, somebody could convince me it was false memory. There's a whole business of convincing people of that. I mean, we can know, but we can't bring the knowledge up into a mental level without losing the certainty, if you see what I mean, without turning it into a kind of certainty that's unhealthy.
Yeah, I mean, my sense of certainty comes from dreams. And if I dream something in a particular way, in a particular place, then I know that it's real. And that those things are, when I wake up in the morning and I have the memory of the dream, and the feeling of the experience, then I know that that is what that thing is. That's what happened. Well, that's what that meant. And part of my going off in my own direction was saying, well, I'm going to listen to that. I've been conditioned to ignore it, and I've been conditioned to say, well, it's not true, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to live my life saying that it is true. And that then has led me to the understanding that I have now. So yeah.
What kind of things are you verifying in dreams? Are you talking about memories or?
Memories and the implicit meaning of something, the implicit meaning of someone's behavior, or the implicit meaning of a memory, the implicit meaning of something that somebody said to me, where I haven't been able to, because of all the competing experience, sort of aspects of that experience, I couldn't decode what happened. And that it had left a scar, and it's the sort of removing of that scarring that that I experience in dreams. And through the day, what I've learned to do is, in terms of saying that, when you say that two things could, competing things could be true, what I've learned is a way to set those things up in my mind, such that I can hold both things in my mind, and then I allow through dreaming those things to become the same thing, to become a different truth in the middle of both of them. And that's a really guiding principle for me in those with those sorts of issues, is that the truth is in the middle. And so I say, well, I can't see the truth now, but it's in the middle. And so I don't say that consciously anymore. I used to do that whilst I was training myself with these issues, but now it's just something that I just do. And so I set those things up, and then I dream about it, and then I've understood what the truth was in the middle. And that is a kind of process of integration. Well, it is integration, yeah. But it's experiential integration. It's not just integration from past trauma, but from daily experience, which is by degrees traumatic as well, or reminding of things that happened in the past.
Yeah. So, do you think that somebody who was even, I mean, more skeptical or more empirically minded than you might see some of your dreaming exercises as fantastic or as improbable.
Of course, yeah, of course they would, yeah, but that's not important to me. It's not important to my commitment in life, my physical commitment to the things that I physically invest in and wish to protect. So they can dispute it if they want. That's up to them, but I'm committed to it, and I'm committed to the consequences of it.
Right. Well, the reason I was asking was because, one man's woo is another man's pragmatism. If you see what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to dispute that, but if I think something's bullshit, I'll say I think that's bullshit. So and then they can convince me otherwise or not. It's just, but I don't see the point from a kind of respect of that sort of relativism to say, oh well, it could be bullshit or it's not. I think that thing or whatever that they're saying is bullshit. So I can be wrong. I've been wrong about lots of things, and I'm willing to learn. And being wrong is a good thing. I mean, that if you are committed to your position, but you find out that you're wrong, you've learned something. So I think it's better to be committed and to commit to yourself, and then to that in, and in that way you experience life more fully, instead of always worrying, well, I might be wrong or I might be right and that sort of thing. I just go off. I just go off what I my sense of what is happening.
And you wouldn't say you've had any experiences that you would describe as inexplicable.
No, I don't think so. No, just puzzling, but not. By inexplicable, do you mean sort of totally outside the bounds of biology or something, or outside the bounds of ordinary experience?
Well, I don't know. I mean, because again, it's. Because people come up with explanations for these things, and they might be even more bogus than the experience themselves. In fact, I'd say they often are. This is a very personal thing, like experiences where you just say, "I can't explain that," and therefore, I don't have all the answers, I guess. About what's possible. Because I mean I agree that Whitley Strieber is it's a whole lot of bullshit there. Of course I agree. I wrote the book on it, but I wouldn't be so fascinated by those experiences if I was able to actually fully dismiss them as bullshit. Like it's become bullshit. It's like something real that's been turned into bullshit, and that's what makes it worth exploring. If it's just a guy lying, I mean, what's the point, right?
Well,
What's the point in it?
they're aspects of a trained imagination, and so the interesting side is the training. What happened? What? Where? What, why was that training? How did the training happen? Who did it?
Yeah, but also the clues with Strieber, and I'd say with de Ruyter, and I'd say with all of these cases and ourselves, the clues are also in, the clues to what kind of training involved are in the bullshit narratives, the crucial fictions. So then they become meaningful, even though it's a fiction. It's pointing to something real.
Yeah, and that is the point at which they are real. They are real in terms of the meaning and in terms of their reverberation within other people's imagination. But the real aspect of it is in how it affects their actions. As in, how does it guide the course of their life? And those things are more grounded in employment, in family relationships. Those sorts of things. That is the testing ground for those things, not the paraphernalia of it itself.
Right. Yeah, which is why it's so pernicious, I'd say, but also so intoxicating or so alluring if a person can turn crucial fictions into a physical consequence, as in can make a living spinning yarns.
And well, I mean, if you look at European aristocracy and so on, you could say that that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, we're back to culture, aren't we? The one big yarn that supports the financial system. Well, I have to start work. Speaking of finances and every day, I have to start working in about 15 minutes. I should probably wind up so I can eat something.